Do you feel that in a time when we are more connected than ever, we are drifting away from real human connection, especially to ourselves? I do. Hi, I'm Leticia Latino, and I want to invite you to join me and my very inspiring guests in exploring ways to reconnect to your essence, to your definite purpose, to what makes you tick. Are you ready? Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of Back to Basics, Reconnecting to the Essence of You. I'm with Stephen Wilson today. He's the author of Teetering on a Tightrope, a memoir that is both deeply personal and a call to action, rallying the reader to dismantle the stigma surrounding mental illness, more specifically bipolar disorder, and finding the support they need to resurrect their lives. For the last 7 years, Steve has been the facilitator of two mental health support groups in Phoenix, Arizona, where he puts his extensive knowledge and firsthand experience to help others deal with bipolar disorder. Hello, Steve, and welcome to Back to Basics.
Hi, Leticia. Glad to be here. Thank you.
I'm very, very excited to have you here. This is a very important subject, and I really always praise people that put their own trauma and difficult journey into the world so that they can help others. So, Steve, I always like to ask about, you know, the origin story. I know, of course, on the book and how the book is promoted that you did have one of your very traumatic experiences as a young boy. But besides that, tell me a little bit about where you're from and what were you passionate about as a young kid? And then, you know, we'll take it from there.
Okay. I am from Delaware, Ohio. I was born in 1948, so I'm an old man.
You're not old. My daddy is 1934. He still goes to work every day.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so you guys are rocking it.
All right. So anyway, I have always been interested in sports. I played basketball. I was a very good golfer. Played tennis. That's what I liked the most. Plus, I love TV.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any particular shows that you love the most? Oh,
now that everything's being streamed, I've got hundreds of them. So
That's good. So, and I understand you enjoy the movies, and yeah, that must have come from your early years.
Yes. I don't go into the movies anymore because of COVID. So now I watch everything on TV.
All right. So it was actually later in life, so to speak, that you decided to write a book about bipolar disorder and your own journey. Yes. How did you come about that whole process?
Well, I still had some lingering things I needed to close in my life. And so I went to a trauma therapist about 4 years ago. And we did my life all the way through from the time of my assault when I was 9 and went through till I was around 70 or 71. It was about 4 years ago. We mapped out everything. And when we got done with it, she told me I ought to write a book about it. Well, I had been a writer at a college in sports field. So I thought, well, what the hell, I'll try it. Hmm. So I wrote the book. It was fairly easy to write because all the content was in my head. Hmm. And so I wrote the book. It was published in just a year ago. I self-published it. And since then, I've started doing podcasts. I've done about 35 of them.
Oh, wow.
And trying to get the word out that you can survive any mental illness, but you will still have a long journey because there is no cure for most mental illnesses. Mm-hmm. And I like to point out the struggles I had. Everything is down there, down and dirty. And at the same time, I like to tell people that they can make it. And I like to tell people about how tough it is to get help in this country for mental illness. The reason for that is twofold. One, the insurance companies have not embraced the care for mental health, and they have forced the professionals into getting less money for the things they do, the sessions they have. And also, they have forced the practitioners to raise their prices. And so it's become a real problem for those of us who don't make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Most people I deal with in my groups don't have the funds to afford a session that costs $150. So they're forced into having government assistance and going to clinics. And in the clinics are so overwhelmed that a lot of times people don't get any help, or the time between sessions is pretty long. And then the government doesn't really think highly of mental illness. They do a couple things, you know, but not much. So all these people fall through the cracks. And that's one of the big things I'd like to get, or three things, is stigma and insurance and the government need to, stigma needs to go away, and the other two need to step up and do something about the problem.
Yeah, that's definitely important to highlight. It's one of the things, you know, my family is Italian. My husband is from the Netherlands, and we have very extensive conversations about, you know, the medical assistance that, you know, they have over there compared to what we have here. And it's really concerning the direction that we are following. But, you know, your book obviously deals with a very specific subject. You took and you said that, where, you know, you lived the tragedy as a 9-year-old boy that was sexually assaulted, and you think that maybe that dealt, you know, led to the bipolar disorder. But I think it's important in that raising awareness. And, you know, I'm a mom of two young kids still. And when you say how to identify symptoms, like, can you share what were some of those symptoms that you started experiencing that may have led you and your parents to take you to see if there's something else that I need to have checked?
Sure, I can. Now, remember, this was back in 1958. So a lot has changed since then. Yes. But when I was sexually assaulted, I decided it was my fault. I don't know why I figured that out. Mm. And that I would tell no one. And I didn't. So for 30 years, I kept it a secret. My parents didn't have a clue. There was poor mental health treatments back then. So if you ask me, did I have much support? I had no support. Mm-hmm. But you want to ask about the symptoms? The first thing that happened to me after I was sexually assaulted about 3 months later, I went into a depression. And deep depression was feeling of worthlessness. No, thought nobody loved me. And on the other hand, I thought, well, I can't come up with any feelings either, so I'm just as bad. I watched TV all the time. I also started not being able to sleep. I was down and just going through the motions to get through the day. Nobody noticed. My parents didn't notice. I don't know how they didn't, because I was really a different person, but they didn't until 1970, 18 years later. My mother figured it out after I graduated from college, and she got me in with my first psychiatrist.
Mm. And she figured it out, you think, because then at that point as an adult, she saw more clear signs of mental illness?
That's when I was at my worst. Suicidal ideations, just watch TV all day, every day. The thing I loved most at that time and wanted to go into as a career was golf. Mm-hmm. And golf, I didn't give a damn about it. So she figured it out. Mm. It took that long.
Interesting. Yeah, I, you know, my kids go to Catholic school, so we have as parents to go through a lot of these, trainings and things. And one thing that they emphasize is changing behavior. Mm-hmm. They really emphasize even small things, like if a child is usually doing this and then all of a sudden completely changes, that should be a red flag. But, you know, in these days, everything goes so fast anyway, that the kids like one thing one day, it's even hard to track. That's why I think, you know, having your book, even if you don't have anybody directly linking in your life, but once you read and you become aware of symptoms of things, then that maybe it helps identify if you were to see anything that aligns.
How old are your kids?
13 and 9.
Okay. Here is one of the big things I'm interested in is teenage mental illness. Mm-hmm. It's out of control.
Yes.
Before we moved to Arizona and I started doing my mental health support groups, I began speaking to high school health classes and psychology classes. And I would give a talk about starting out with how in my life I had two young kids commit suicide. Mm. One of the kids worked for me at my clothing store at Christmas time, I would have them wrap packages and run errands because we were too busy to do it. So I hired this one little girl. She was about 16, and she was really cool, bubbly, cute, had a zest for life, perfect worker. I thought she was the greatest. I thought she was going to go a long way. One morning, her best friend came in, told me the night before, Angie, the girl who worked for me, had gone to bed and killed herself.
Mm.
That pretty much shook me up. And I, as I said, I started talking to those classes. And at the end of each of my talks, I would invite any kid who wanted to come up and talk to me personally about what they were going through. First girl to come up was the number one student in the school. She was very attractive, very beloved, and she was the top student, as I said. She was a top athlete. She had everything going for her. She says, "Mr. Wilson, I can't take it anymore. I'm under so much pressure to be the best that it's just driving me crazy. I want to get out of here." And she, I told her the only thing I can help her with is to send her to a child psychologist, and I never saw her again. The very next girl who came up was a normal kid, 16 years old. She says, "Mr. Wilson, I want to die. I have no friends. My parents hate me. I'm really down and out." Well, I told her about the child psychologist, and again, I never saw her again. But as I looked into teenage depression over the years, I find out that it is rampant in this country and all around the world. In the United States alone, 20% of teenagers suffer from some kind of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
It is exactly the same for the adults. And if you put it all together, that's 60 million people suffering in this country, most of them not getting any help. And when we came to Arizona, I got involved in a support a company that sponsors. We have about 10 support groups. I do two of them. And I've been doing it for 8 years. The big thing I have found is that many of the people in my support group, aged 18 to 79, I think, were abused sexually or beaten or berated all the time as they were growing up. And this combination has led to the ruination of their lives. Mm. It is rampant also throughout the world. And these people suffer so much. I've had people who've been trafficked. I've had people who've been sexually assaulted by more than one person at the time. I've had people who've been kidnapped. And it's really out of control.
Mm. No, that it's, I totally agree. It's a very sad situation. I have personally had two friends commit suicide, one of them as recent as last year and out of the blue, like you could not have even guessed it. If I had, you know, to say that person is going to do this, I would never imagine. So that really makes it, as you say, real, that this, it trips into our heads, you know, somehow. And that's why this work that you do is so important. And that's why this is really a special episode with a special format, because I think there's so many things in this that I wanted to touch, you know, especially, for example, like, what is it like if I'm somebody that I feel deep down that I'm not right, and I even if it's diagnosed or not diagnosed, there's many people that have been misdiagnosed. So what specific actions would you advise to either the person that's going through this or somebody close by that identifies something might be wrong?
The best thing anybody can do who has a child or a sibling or a good friend, and also the people around the person who is suffering, the best thing people can do is support them. They are not professionals. They can't give them advice. Of course, everybody does. They tell the guy who's suffering to go take a walk or go to a movie or whatever. That's not what he needs or she needs. They need people to say, oh, I'm so sorry what you're going through. How can I help? And also try, but don't force the individual to get help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, I think it's an important thing to try, but not force. I think that's valuable there. And you know, I read somewhere you've been married for 50 years. So 51. Congratulations. Now 51. Wow, that's very impressive. So I can only imagine, and you have three grown children. I can only imagine the toll that the family and the people close to somebody goes through. I mean, you were suffering through your journey, but then you have others that are around you that I'm sure, you know, your bipolar diagnosis affected the family life. What can you share in that front and also provide advice and perspective to people that surround somebody with mental illness?
Well, the people most affected were my wife and my kids. Again, I say up until 85 or 90, I didn't tell anybody. So, but my wife specifically told me a few weeks ago as we were talking about the effect I'd had on them. She said that the first 7 or 8 years were horrible dealing with me. I didn't know it. I didn't have a clue. I was focused on myself. Also, at that time, I was misdiagnosed. They had decided I was clinically depressed in 70. And then 8 years later, they said they made a mistake and I'm bipolar. That's when I started getting the help I needed. But for those 6, 7, 8 years, I was screwed up. And I got lithium, and that set me on the road to recovery. And in 2000, 22 years later, I got the last medication I needed. See, most people who have mental illness have cocktails, we call them, more than one medication. I take 4. Some people, and I got the last one that completed my circle. And since then, I've been pretty damn good. The first time I got up the guts to tell my psychiatrist that I had been sexually assaulted. He completely ignored me, never let me talk about it. It was as if he thought I was lying. So everybody watch out for who you get as your psychiatrist. Make sure that you're in tune and in line, and make sure you like them and trust them.
Mm.
Remember, they work for you. You don't work for them. So you should have the upper hand.
Mm. Good advice. Good advice. And what's your take, since you touch upon medications and, you know, there's so many thought schools on that. Some people are, you know, very pro, you know, everything natural. Because I as a mom, again, with young kids, I know of other kids that maybe have been diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, and they want to medicate the kids. And then the mom says, should I not? So I'm interested in hearing your perspective with that.
Well, there are actually a few different scenarios about taking medication. The one I'm in is the group that says, damn it, I'm going to take it. I'm going to make sure I follow the instructions and go for it. If I hadn't, I'd be dead now. Then there's the other group, another group that says, well, I'll try it. But when they try it and they're told that it takes a month or so to get into the system and start working, so when they try it for a month or so and say it has little effect, or it hasn't started affecting them yet, they stop. They just quit and never try again, not realizing that if this one didn't work, there are a lot of others that can work. Hmm. Then there's the group that says, I'm going to take the pill or whatever medication you give me, and 6 months later, they're feeling pretty damn good. So they say, I don't need the medication anymore. Stop taking it. A couple weeks later, they're back down in the toilet.
Hmm.
And then there's the group that is totally afraid to take medication, and they don't. And they'll never know if it would have helped. 50% of the people who are suffering do not get much relief from medication. That's just the way it is. And so they have to, if they know about it, which is a question mark, most people don't, there are modalities they can use by themselves or in a group to give them relief without medication. Some of these are EMDR, which is eye movement. Some of them are behavioral therapy. But there's just a host of them, and they can work. But you have to work at it, because it isn't an overnight thing. It's usually several days and times you have to do it. So you got the two groups, those who get help and those who don't. And that means there's a lot of people out there who don't get any good out of medication.
Mm. Well, I think you definitely are inspirational in the sense that, you know, you never stop looking for, you know, ways, because if as you share, it's only 7 years ago that you were doing this with writing a book, most people probably say, you know, at retirement age, I just want to go play golf and be okay. But you were still searching and you were still finding ways. And now you have more tools even than what you had before to help others. And that's very admirable.
Very important to me.
Yeah. And so anything that you want to share as we reach the end of the interview, but I want you to touch upon your work as a facilitator. I know you're very committed to that. And really, what is exciting? What's your mission now as you release this book with this important subject?
Well, the mission has a couple reasons I am doing this. One is to lower the terrible stigma against mental illness. It's bad, and people cannot, those who don't have any connection to mental illness, cannot understand what we go through. If I try to tell somebody how bad it was at my worst, they can listen to my words, but they can't feel it. They can't, They can't grasp how bad it is. So I'm trying to remove the stigma. And the other thing I'm trying to do is to get people out there and realized that, yeah, there's no cure for most mental illness, including bipolar, but you can still have a good life if you really stick with it, do what they tell you to do, and it can be worth it. You can have a good life, you can have a good family, and there'll be ups and downs, and it will always be around, but you can still enjoy life.
What a powerful message. I appreciate that, Steve. And definitely, you know, I will have a link in the show notes so that people can look up your book. And you've been on many podcasts, so you can look Steve Wilson up, and other amazing interviews such as this one will show up. And now, so, you know, this podcast is in great part about what makes us tick. So obviously, you know, somebody that has had the challenges, the difficult journey, but also good life said by yourself, what does Steve do when you want to like resource yourself, recenter yourself, that makes you feel connected to your soul and your essence?
Well, the things I like to do most are, God, one thing I really like to do is the podcasts and things. They really center me, and my groups center me. I get as much out of those as the rest of the people. I love listening to audiobooks and watching TV. That's when I'm most comfortable at those times.
Well, I now know who am I going to call. Call Steve for a TV show recommendation, because you look like you're probably going to have a few ones for me. Steve, I thank you for your time, and you've really been an inspiration, and thank you for sharing your journey with the Back to Basics audience.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it a lot.
Thank you. And to all of you out there, you know, now you know, if you know somebody struggling with anything that we discuss, mental illness, and you want to give them a ray of hope, please direct them to this amazing episode with Steve Wilson. Thank you so much. And until the next episode, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Back to Basics. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you haven't yet, subscribe, rate and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or any of your favorite streaming platforms. This is the best gift you can give us. Join me next week for another Back to Basics conversation. And if you want to find out about other exciting things I'm working on, visit leticialatino.com. Thank you, and until the next time.